Welcome to our special 7 questions edition of How to Win a Campaign. I'm Joe Fold, and you can find us at the Campaign Workshop on Instagram or on Threads. In this series, we're talking with some of our favorite authors, content creators, and influencers. You can find the 7 questions blog post that inspired this conversation at thecampaignworkshop.com or in the show notes. Today's guest is Hal Malchow. Hal is a political consulting pioneer and writer. As the chairman of MSHC Partners, where we work together, Hal drove the use of experiments and advanced data analytics to improve political targeting and campaign strategy. He's worked with the DNC, the U.S. Olympic Committee, Planned Parenthood, and 5 Democratic presidential candidates. He's been recognized for his revolutionary work with the Cisco Award from the Direct Marketing Association in 2005 and was inducted into the American Association of Political Consultants Hall of Fame in 2016. His work is also chronicled in Sasha Eisenberg's book, The Victory Lab, and he has written 6 books on political strategy, political fiction, political thrillers, and young adult fantasy novels. Hey, Hal, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You and I worked together years ago at MSHC Partners. I'm like, got the book, Reinventing Political Advertising, in the mail, read like a bunch of it. I'm actually in the process of reading it for a second time because that's what I do. But the book talks about the ineffectiveness of political advertising and what steps we can take to improve them. Can you give me a couple ideas for our listeners about what you would suggest?
Well, first, let me talk about the ineffectiveness. There were a couple of polls done recently. They were done by YouGov, and one of them compared the percentage of voters who say they pay less attention to political ads versus all other ads. And this has grown from 28% to 44%. We have 58% say that political ads have no influence at all on their choice of who to vote for. One of the problems with measuring persuasion advertising is that you have to contact a lot of people, you have to have a treatment and control group, and you need a large quantity of completed calls in each group. So it's very expensive. But there are 2 political scientists, David Brockman and Josh Kalla, who pulled together results from 46 experiments to measure how political advertising was working. And they found that the political ads, there was mail, there was digital, there was television, there were robocalls, there were everything was in this collection of 46 experiments. They found that there were statistically significant effects on vote choice in primaries and in ballot measures. But among general elections, the effect size was 0. 0. And so clearly, there's a crisis in political advertising. And I think it's due to 2 things. The bad news is there's a crisis and it's not performing well. The good news is you can fix it if people would pay attention. So there are 2 issues. One is the targeting. For decades, we have had one formula for deciding which voters we need to talk to. And that formula was which voters are undecided. It was targeted by looking at the continuum of likelihood of being a Democrat or Republican and targeting toward the 50% people. We have been asking the wrong question. The question is not whether someone is undecided. The question is, can you move these voters with political advertising? And the resounding answer, and I can talk about as many experiments as you want to hear, probably more than you want to hear, the answer is the people who are moved by advertising are low information voters. When I say that, I'm talking about people who know very little about politics. Now, let me give you probably the best example. In 2010, now note, this is 2010. This is 14 years ago. We've known this for 14 years and no one has acted on it. But the New Mexico NEA did an experiment where they sent 3 mailings to their members but put aside a control group so that they could contact these people after they received the mailings, ask them who they were for, and look at whether the mailings that they did had moved any voters at all. And the mailing said, well, the stats said they moved 3 points, which is a good result. But there was just a happenstance episode that took place where at the last minute, before they made the calls, the survey company called Todd Rogers, who is executive director at the Analyst Institute, and said, Todd, you've paid for one more question than you're asking. What would you like to ask? And Todd, being the brilliant son of a bitch that he is, he now teaches at Harvard, he gave an answer no one at the Analyst Institute or the NEA or anywhere else understood. He said, ask the voters whether or not they know which party controls Congress. Now, the universe here was people who voted in 2006 and 2008. So they weren't a bunch of deadbeats. They were people who voted in all major elections. One third of them could not tell you which party controlled Congress. Among the voters who knew which party controlled Congress, the movement was 0.6 percentage point in the direction of the Democratic nominee. Among the people who did not know, the movement was 19 points, 31 times the movement of those who actually knew which party controlled Congress. You know, in the book, I think I have 7 or 8 experiments that all show the same thing. When you look at that great big meta-analysis where they put together 46 experiments, well, why would the primary, in the primaries, the advertising worked, and why would in the ballot measures the primary work, but not in the general election? And the reason is people know a lot more about the candidates in a general election than they do in either of the other two.
So my question there, just to jump in, was, do you think low information voter varies on the kind of race we're talking about?
Because, absolutely. One of the best experiments that I looked at, or analyses that I looked at in going through and doing research for this book, there were 3 academics that accessed election data and television advertising for 4,500 races over a 10-year period. Well, what did they find? They found if you had 100 ad advantage in a presidential race, you moved the needle 0.02 percentage point. If you were in a Senate race, you moved 0.04. If you were in a congressional race, you moved 0.08. But if you were in an attorney general's race, you moved 1,600. And if you were in the state treasurer's race, you moved 0.33 percentage point. Well, why is that? Most people know a lot about the candidates who are running for president, but no one even knows who's running for state treasurer. Again, underscoring the importance of understanding which voters are uninformed.
Totally.
Now, the second reason that advertising is working so poorly is the television advertisers are not paying any attention to the data, and they're not testing this stuff. We have testing that goes on now, pre-testing, but in a lot of ways, it will help you understand whether an ad is better than average, but it won't tell you in any sense what the actual effect size is, because the voters who look at these ads are paid to look at them. And that's a completely artificial experience because the people who vote, they're not paid to watch the ads. They hate the ads. On the internet, people pay money not to see the ads. Advertising is a weak way to communicate with anyone, and the political advertising is worse. So there have been other experiments, particularly in the mail, where we have sent people a mailing, a cheap-looking mailing, and that's important. So no one sits around scratching their heads wondering which billionaire paid for this, right? So you want to look as cheap as possible. 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper folded in half with a letter. Who sends a letter anymore inside? And the letter says, all right, we're the Center for Voter Information. Our goal is to provide voters with unbiased information about the candidates who are running for Senate or governor or whatever you choose. And it asks 3 questions. It says, do you favor extending paid family leave for 4 weeks for women who just had childbirth or something like that. But the issue always stated in a neutral way so that no one can read the question and go, oh, I know which side they're on. Just neutral way. And then you have yes and no at the bottom. Then at the last paragraph, it said sometimes the answers are more complicated than yes or no. Here are the websites of the candidates. If you want more information, we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that does not endorse any candidates. Well, so we did a three-way test in the special election in Pennsylvania 18. We did regular mail, and we did what we call false positive mail, where we took controversial statements and created pieces that looked like they came from our opponent, and we did the information-only mailing. Neither the traditional mail or the false positive mail had any effect on the voters, but the information-only mailing moved a point and a half. And, you know, I mean, you may think a point and a half, you know, that's pretty small, but that's big. When you compare it with other measurements across the board in all mediums, a point and a half is a big deal. Advertising is not a strong way to convince people of anything. So a point and a half, that was pretty big. So they rolled it out. They probably did, I think they did, like 70, 80 million pieces of mail in the congressional races, in the governor's races, in the Senate races. And the person who did the measurement stated, after analyzing all the precinct returns all over the country, that we would not have won the House in 2018 had we not used this tactic. Well, why did this work? It worked because it focused not on, you know, playing exorcist music and showing this ugly picture of your opponent with one eye half closed. It worked because it looked like credible information. People don't know a lot about candidates or politics, particularly as you move down the ballot. And the challenge is getting them to believe what you say. And no wonder, given all the advertising that we've run that's twisted everything that anyone said that shows our opponent maybe with three eyes instead of two, you know, that sort of stuff. People are fed up with it, and that's why the polls show that 58% of the voters don't even count advertising at all in their choice of candidates. The credibility that this format provided was a breakthrough. Have you ever seen a TV ad that tries to do this? These guys who do the TV ads have so much hubris that they can't even entertain the idea that maybe the best solution is not sitting in their mind and on their sample shelf, right? The degree to which practitioners in our profession have ignored data is shocking.
Yeah, you wrote the book, The New Political Targeting, in 2003, right? And you right. and I was there at MSHC when you wrote that book. And in there, you talk about like social pressure, you talk about targeting and being much more deliberate about targeting. My question is, as folks like utilize some of these tactics, like social pressure, for instance, has been utilized a lot, do you think you see diminishing return on some of the tactics that do work as far as tests?
I have not been on top of the GOTV mail. I know that we're still doing social, that really the two big tactics for turnout are social pressure and vote by mail. And we've been able to fine tune all of this. And the reason we can fine tune it is because it's so cheap to measure, right?
Right.
So you take your treatment, you take your control, you match it to the voter list, you see who voted, you don't have to make a single call. The expense is nominal. And that's why we progressed so much and we have so much hard knowledge about what works in voter turnout. But in persuasion, no one is spending the money. And listen, I saw an estimate the other day where some prognosticator or expert of some kind predicted that in 2024, there would be $16 billion spent in advertising, political advertising. I think he said this would make it the 10th biggest advertising market in the world. Do you think people in the commercial area who are doing this advertising at large volumes aren't measuring their effects? Of course they are. Now, their effects are easier because, you know, if you advertise Clorox bleach, you put out the ads, you see what it costs, and, you know, and you see how many sales you get. It's more complicated for us. It's a lot more complicated for us. But why in the world would we not be taking some of that $16 billion? Probably $500 million would be extraordinary in terms of all the knowledge that we would gain. All the knowledge we would gain, you might find that a number of my ideas in my book weren't practical or effective. But to the extent we found that, we would learn new lessons that would cause us to be able to formulate even better strategies. This is the key. You have businesses, particularly in the technology industry, that spend 24% of their revenues on R&D, right? 24%. We're going to spend a half percentage point. And that's why when you take 46 experiments and you put them together and you say, oh, how did we affect these general elections? And the answer is you didn't affect them one bit. There's a crisis in political advertising, and it's a knowledge crisis and it's a targeting crisis, both of these. And until we solve this, we're going to continue to have experiments that tell us we're not making any difference at all.
So get to the advice then for organizations, candidates, consultants these days is I'm hearing loud and clear, which is actually test, right? Spend a budget for testing. But other advice you have?
Number one idea is pick up the telephone and call Catalyst and call Target Smart and say, when in the hell are you going to get us a voter information model? This is critical to taking these lessons and putting them into effect. So we have this New Mexico experiment. 31 times the impact by targeting low information voters. Now, you know, there are a bunch of other experiments that may have, maybe it's seven, you know, or eight, or, you know, numbers like this. These are big numbers. What if we, in every race where we had a contested contest between Democrats and Republicans, if we were able to increase our advertising effectiveness a mere four times, how many more of these races would we win? We would win a lot of them. But we're not going to win them until our practitioners pay attention to the research.
Sure. And then earlier we talked about like low information voters and just the vary on the kind of race, on a local race versus a national race, right? There are people that pay attention in national politics, people who don't pay attention to local politics at all. How do you solve for that variable?
I think you solve for it. If you're doing state legislative races, probably the voter information dimension is it's close to useless because people don't have much information about these candidates. I mean, if you build a model that attempts to measure the information level of each voter, you know, you might have 10% in a state legislative race that you could drop, and it may make sense to do news programming. So now that we know all this about low information voters, do you know where television advertising is going? For the last 20 years, the average percentage of television ads that have been placed on news programming has been 55%. If you took all of that ad spending and placed it randomly, you know, without any strategy whatsoever, you would probably double our effect sizes because we're focusing all our ads on exactly the people who won't be moved.
Yeah, I mean, it's also like, I mean, we're now at a level where it's less than 25% of the population is watching broadcast news, period, with the advent of streaming. That number is continuing to go down and down. And you're right. You know, it's like why in the other 55%, you see like Jeopardy and other shows where there's a ton of ads. It's because they're trying to find eyeballs that are on broadcast TV and it's hard to find.
Well, yes, this is true. The coverage problem for television is complicated. Now, there are things that are happening in television which will make it more efficient. And that is that Netflix and Disney and Hulu already does it. Now allow you to take a voter list of your targets, which are exactly the people you want to talk to, match it and show the ads only to those people. There are problems here. One of the problems is that obviously if Hulu has an offer to buy their whole audience and you're in there and you say, well, you know, I'm targeting the 16%, they're going to sell to the company that's talking to everybody. So the availability is not always there. But the good news is that the availability should be there to test advertising, to create treatment and control groups, show the one side ads and the other side doesn't see ads. And then, you know, then you have the names of these people and you can call them and suddenly it's still expensive, but none of it is expensive in compared to what we're spending, what we're wasting. But it's a mechanism that allows you to do good, effective television ad measurements.
Overall, it's finding these audiences and getting in front of them, whether it's, you know, mail, digital television is just going to continue to be harder.
Here's the other thing. You've got the question of who can you persuade? And you've got this low information variable, which is shockingly powerful yep. in terms of predicting who would move. There's another variable that has developed in recent years, and that's what medium are people watching? You know, some people you can't even reach on broadcast television, right? You've got some people who are spending 10 hours a day on the internet. And then you have people who read their mail and don't read their mail. I know Catalyst has excellent measurements on the predictions on these variables. So not surprisingly, what tests have shown, if someone's spending 10 hours a day on the internet, if you run internet ads, that they're going to work a lot better on that voter. If they're stuck in front of the TV all day long and all night long, the television ads are going to be more effective. So what if you created a persuasion score that combined the information level, combined the media usage, and you could throw in the, you know, being in the middle of the partisan scale, and if it worked at all, you know, it would be in your equation. And you put these three together and created three separate indexes, a persuasion index for digital, a persuasion index for television, and a persuasion index for mail. Then if you're a campaign manager, you don't have to go, oh, God, what am I going to do? Television, digital, mail, right? No, it's all there in front of you. The people who are targeted for mail, you send mail to. The people who are targeted for TV, you run the TV ads. It's a little complicated. You've got to figure out the coverage on all of this, which you can always get coverage in the mail. And then once you have these three scores, you multiply them by the turnout probabilities so that you're measuring how likely is it that they're persuadable and they show up at the polls on election day. You had these three things, it would totally simplify the campaign manager's job in making these decisions, and it would make everything you do much more effective.
I guess
if you could get four times the effect size just off the low information targeting, and you threw in the digital targeting, what would be the multiplier here? It would be substantial enough to reshape the outcomes of a lot of elections.
Yeah. So you talked about advice for organizations, which is to, you know, sort of be more diligent about testing and the models that you use. What about for folks going into politics and advocacy these days? Any advice that you would give?
Don't dwell on the conventional wisdom. Read my book and think about how to do these things differently.
Hal, like in our years of working together, you've never worried about going a different direction than other folks. You know, how do you sort of keep that internal compass and always have new ideas? How do you do that?
One, I don't believe anything just because someone tells me or that everyone's doing it. Two, I don't sit around and wring my hands about decisions. You know, I look at a problem, I make a decision, and then I figure, okay, how do I actuate this? And I do it. And, you know, I think just by my personality, I cut down the time between contemplation and action.
One of the things that I always like learned from you is you started multiple businesses. You know, we worked together at MSHC, which was at one point the largest political consulting company in the country on the voter contact side. And you've built great teams of people to work together on a common goal. Any advice on how you do that? Just asking for a friend?
I think it's fairly simple. Is you treat your employees really well, you give them opportunities for advancement, and you focus on getting them engaged in new ideas and improving their skills. I once went, I think it was 6 years, without a professional level staff person leaving the firm. And that's probably made me prouder than just about anything in my business life. Joe, it was a sad day when we lost you, but you know, you're better suited for running your own company. You're a little like me. You have these ideas and you act on them, and you don't care whether you get applause from the people who are doing television ads. You're an independent thinker. That's important, and you are never going to be as good as you have become working in someone else's firm.
I think I learned a ton to get to this place by working with you. And I think that's the other thing, is like having people that I learned from who were independent thinkers, who were able to sort of beat their own drum and do their own thing. I learned a ton of that from you. So that's the first thing. But what I always thought was amazing was that you always had ideas that you kept coming. I mean, I remember coming into MSHC and I would think that I'm an early riser. So I would walk in the door at about 8:30. And you would have been there for 3-4 hours.
I am an early riser.
What I also loved was you always had a lot of things going on. You had the data side that you were working on, data projects. You had the creative side in which you were working on designs for mail. How do you keep the ideas coming? How did you keep the ideas coming?
Just by being absorbed in the work. Probably as much pleasure as I ever got was from having an idea that went against all the conventional wisdom, making it happen, measuring it, and being successful.
The other thing that I always felt was amazing at working at MSHC, especially working with you, was a lack of fear of like conflict. I always think that there's good conflict and bad conflict, but having a discussion, having an argument, having differences of opinion can actually make something better.
That's right.
And I never felt like you shied away from differences of opinion.
No. Even from your mistakes, you get valuable lessons. And so it all had to be on the table. No one knows everything. I tried not to shut down a discussion just because I disagreed with what someone was suggesting. To the extent we could test it, we would test it.
And the other part that I thought was super interesting and love your feedback on this was you weren't afraid of taking risks, right? You started a data part of the company when no one else was doing it. You started doing modeling when no one else was doing it. You started doing digital advertising when no one else was doing it. And you always have had a philosophy of the benefit of risks. And especially in the political sphere, that is rare.
It is. But here's what I used to tell people. You know, you have an idea. Let's say the idea cost $100,000 to execute. You know, in most cases, that $100,000 idea, if it works, is probably worth $1 million. And so what I used to tell people when they go, oh, I don't know, you know, if this is risky. My philosophy was that if you hit 1 out of 7 of these ideas, you would be ahead financially. So, you know, don't be afraid.
Totally. That is definitely words to live by, to try different things.
You know, if I'm in the business and I'm doing the same thing everyone else is doing, am I changing anything? You know, if they use another consultant, they're going to get the same results. My only opportunity to change the outcomes is doing things differently.
Absolutely. All right. So what has inspired you? Do you have a favorite book, movie, podcast that you drew inspiration from in like writing your books and building these businesses?
I had to do a lot of things. I went back to school and took 3 statistics courses, you know, to try to get myself ready to do bigger things. I read a lot. There are a lot of books I love. But in terms of helping me professionally, the best book I ever read was David Allen's Making Things Work, which before I read this book, you know, I always had like a big pile of paper on my desk and things unorganized. And he taught me discipline on the basic organizational components. And and I remember after I read the book, you know, I went and I organized all my paperwork and put it in files with lettered tape to say what everything was. And one of my staff people walked into my office and my desk was completely clean, and she almost fainted, right? But it helped me a lot. It made me, I don't know, 50% more efficient in everything I did. This is a great book. David Allen, Getting Things Done.
I remember actually reading it when you handed it out. You handed it out to staff.
Yeah, I read it to everybody, you know.
Yeah,
I don't think everyone was interested, but anyway, I tried.
You've had a couple different, like, I would say, careers, right, in this business. You started in fundraising, then you moved to persuasion, then you really got involved in Voter Participation Center and working with them, and then, like, now writing books. Talk a little bit about your evolution of the different things that you've done and how you've done it.
Well, so I started in fundraising. This is important because when I got to persuasion, and we're putting out all this mail, and, you know, in fundraising, you get a report card on everything you send out. No one ever goes to the conference room and says, let's have a meeting to decide whether this worked. It's all right there in front of you. And I was just kind of baffled. You know, here we are putting out all these pieces of mail, and you know, what everyone loves is the big, splashy, dramatic piece. And does that work? I don't know. No one had any idea. So I got really interested in the measurement. Actually, I funded the start of the Analyst Institute, which I'm always very proud of. You know, the targeting was somewhat of a piece of that because you could use statistics to look at different mediums and how they worked for turnout. And it was just kind of an evolution. And finally, I just got really kind of disgusted with the campaigns we were doing. This is 2010. So what are the issues confronting the American people? Climate change, we could all fry. We've got Social Security and Medicare heading for insolvency. We got crime problems. We've got deficits. The list of problems was staggering. And what were we doing mail about? You know, the main piece that we did that year was either our opponent took a pay raise or we didn't take a pay raise, right? The trivial stuff. Because these other issues were too big. The candidates were afraid of them. But I found it disgusting. So that's when I got out. And at that point, I spent about 8 productive years with the Voter Participation Center helping guide their experimental agenda. And we really learned a lot that's being used today and that are important elements of everything we do, particularly in turnout.
Well, Hal, was there a question you wish I asked today that I didn't get to ask?
No. If there was, I intruded and answered it before you asked it.
I mean, that's okay. I'm used to that, but that's great. Well, listen, Hal, thank you so much for the conversation. Love talking with you, and I really appreciate it. And I appreciate your mentorship and friendship
thank
over the
you.
Years.
I appreciate your partnership and contributions to my success. Send me the link because I want to send it to my 1,700 potential book buyers and hopefully sell some more books.
We will definitely do that for sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Hal, thank you so much for joining us and for all you've done. For more on this topic, check out our blog at thecampaignworkshop.com. You can find out more about Hal Malchow at halmalchow.com. If you want to hear more of these interviews, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, I'm Joe Fold breaking down How to Win a Campaign. How to Win a Campaign is Joe Fold, Martin Diego Garcia, Elizabeth Rowe, Phoebe Retta, Samantha Sondek, and Lauren Odom. Music by Daniel Pinto. Audio editing by Christopher Lang. Special thanks to the team at the Campaign Workshop. Please review, like, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.